Welcome, everyone. This is Taking Your Web Talent to the Video Game Industry. And my name is Adam Duvander, and I do not work in the video game industry. I am the moderator today, but we have four people with unique experience, and I think they will provide a balanced view, and they're all real intelligent people, and so they will be able to give you some good advice today. Sort of introduction into how it came about is it started as a of the idea of what can the web learn from gaming, kind of the other direction, which is how can websites be more engaging, sort of like games are. And so I think we'll touch on that a little bit, as well as touch on how the web has impacted gaming as well. But first, I want to let the panelists introduce themselves. And as you do, panel, if you could talk a little bit about how you see the connection between web and video games, kind of an introduction to what we'll dig deeper into later on.
Oh, great. Hi, I'm Mike Duffy. My last real job was as the manager of the game division for Mindscape, a large console and PC game publisher. About 20 years ago, I wrote a program called Chess Master with a couple other guys, which went on to be a minor hit in its own genre. And what do I think about moving from the web to video games? Or why the web has some interaction applicability? I think the web really opened people's eyes to interactivity. The game market has always been about interactive, whether it's on the web or whether it's in a console or whether it's on a PC. So I think it's all about creating compelling and engaging experiences, regardless of the medium. I mean, I think there's a universal gaminess to things, and you can express that in lots of different ways. So I think the talents that people who come from the web have are equally relevant. I just I hesitate to say that it's all fun and games. As anything becomes more of a business, now where you see console games that take $5 to $10 million and a couple of years to turn out, I think that there are the pressures associated with a large revenue business. And so it's not all happy all the time. I mean, some of you are probably familiar with the suits that were brought against EA by the people who were working countless hours of overtime. More of a sweatshop than a game shop, if you will. So it's not all unalloyed fun, but there is fun to be had.
Hi, I'm Naomi Clark. I think I need to move this a little closer. And I work at a company called Game Lab. We're an independent game developer in New York City. We mostly make downloadable games that you are distributed probably 90% through the web. And I come from a web background. I was originally a web designer back in the sort of mid and late 90s. And I think Michael kind of said a lot of it. The fact that they're both they're the interactive media now that the days of the Voyager CD-ROM have kind of passed. So if there's any medium that I would say you could make a jump between the two, it's probably, the web and games are pretty close, a lot closer than film and games, despite what some people would like to believe is true about narrative. I think it's a very exciting time. Games are sort of becoming more like the web in some ways. There's more little cracks and niches here and there where you can sort of do your own things, start small, have your own creative projects and so forth. So I think that they're having a good effect on each other.
My name is Jameson Su. I'm the CEO of a company called Mochi Media, and we operate a platform for game developers, mostly independent game developers, and you can consider us the AdSense of games, and we help individuals making games monetize them. Our platform is entirely run via the web. We're not console, we're not handheld device or PC games. It's all flash-based games, so the people that we really see within our ecosystem are exactly that, web developers. And people that have skills within the web realm and really testing their passion for gaming in the world of distributed content via Flash games. We've seen some incredible games come out, and from people that you would never expect. One of our top performers was he was a former CPA, so if you can believe that, a guy that used to do accounting is now one of the best game developers out there. It's pretty amazing. And I think if you have the passion and if you have the sort of the ideas to come up with great games, there's technology. Flash is great for it to step into this world.
Quick history. I went to RIT, have a degree in photography. I started with Authorware about 15 years ago, moved to Portland, worked on my own for that long, doing director, then Flash. Pretty much Flash brochure websites. The biggest one I did was most exposure, I should say, is the cattle auction, Stampede Cattle. During a 90-minute auction, they'll sell something like $2 million worth of cows, up to like $10 million, so it's kind of nuts. But recently I've done some Flash games for MSN Messenger, and these are pretty huge games as far as on the calendar. There's a Sudoku 2 two-player game, Jigsaw 2, Tic-Tac-Poker, and then there's various variations of those games. So I've been doing games pretty heavily, maybe for just a year, and so I guess my main point about getting into games and compared to web is it's really not that much different. You can you focus on details that you think you're good at, but really I think stepping back, like when you choose whatever you do, if it's choosing to go towards games or whatever, you better just pick something you like and that you enjoy, because sort of two reasons. It's your life. It's running out. You only have so much time left, so you better do what you like. And then you'll spend a lot of time on these things. And the big takeaway I've gotten from doing these games is that at least for these bigger games, the budgets, the timelines are bigger. So you're going to be sticking with it for a while. And that's also the attraction for me, because as an independent, I don't like doing all these lots of little jobs that I have to run around constantly looking for new clients. So that's why it's attractive to me.
All right. So we'd like to find out a little bit more about who's here listening. And so can just raise your hand if right now you are in some capacity working in gaming. Okay, so there are a few. People who are really seriously wanting to look for their next job to be in gaming in some way. All right. Yeah.
How many people in here are on the art side of things?
That's a good question.
Okay, and how many of you are geeky programmer types like me? Okay, and how many are none of the above? Okay. Two of you, great. That's the, there's three kinds of people in gaming, right? There's artists, there's programmers, and there's suits. That's the universe.
And Mike, you will talk a little bit about that in a little bit, the different roles. I want to invite anyone, if you have a question, we're not going to wait till the end. There's a microphone in the center right there, and so whenever you have one, just stand up there, and if I'm paying attention, I'll see you, and then we'll go to your question. That way we can keep it as a kind of a conversation, and I'm not the only one asking questions. So we're going to start, though, with Naomi's going to give an overview of the types of games and the types of platforms where the games might be, to kind of give us an idea of what sort of areas we're talking about.
Right, and I'm sure a lot of this is not going to come as huge news to many of you, but there are, especially when we were talking about this topic and what kind of jobs are people looking for, what areas are you looking to get into, there are really huge differences depending on what platform you're talking about. So, how many of you would say to have regularly played video games on a console, PlayStation, Xbox, Wii, like everybody, right? So, and then how about on the PC? Also pretty good. Okay. So those are sort of, your two major platforms. Although in terms of revenues, the consoles have, been dominating the PC for a while. But I'd like to encourage you all not to try and get into the console game business. It's much harder and not necessarily as rewarding. if you do happen to know someone at a big console gaming company, or you know, it's much more like how to get a job anywhere, right? You got to apply, you have to see if you meet their the job qualifications and so forth. I don't know if us telling you like how to fix up your resume and go into an interview at a huge console company like that is really going to be the best focus of this panel. What I think is really interesting, especially about taking web skills to the game industry, is in other platforms, especially on the PC and on the web, the type of stuff that Jameson's company does, and platforms underneath the sort of the online and PC umbrella. So, for instance, there are Facebook games, very big, popular, new field right now, you know, just came up in the last year or so. And, the game industry, huge companies like EA are sitting up and taking notice and starting whole new divisions to try and focus on Facebook games. And the Facebook games out there that are popular all have been developed by web developers. So that should be exciting news for those of you who are, you know, as the title of this panel says, looking to take your web skills to the game industry. Other interesting areas, you know, like Jameson was mentioning, Flash games and just putting out small Flash games that could be made by, you know, a group of 1 to 3 people and making advertising-based revenue off of that still seems to be one of the biggest revenue models for online games. And other types of websites, there are games out there that are entirely made with web development tools that run on things like PHP, that are using Ajax, tools like that can raise the interactive potential of the web to new heights. And those things are really interesting. They're often made by 1 or 2 people, but can accumulate very, very large communities. And so I think that's really where to look, the sort of where the game industry is actually moving right now, what areas it's moving into. And games are moving into the web. So I'd suggest just your basic piece of advice, don't try to like jump onto the, you know, the back of the elephant, sort of try to run up the trunk instead, since it's sort of already heading in the direction of the web. I don't know if I was supposed to run down any other platforms here, but there's obviously a lot of different business models on the web. Like I said, my company mostly does PC games that are distributed digitally, and there's more and more of that going on. It'll probably become the, you know, main form of distribution in the next 10 years. And there's also mobile games, which are probably worth saying a word or two about at some point. But if you're on the web, why not make games on the web?
And Nomi, can you talk about the different styles of a game?
So the I guess this is sort of a list of genres.
Yeah, and you don't have to mention everyone, but you know, maybe the common ones you see and those that and some big players there, you know, some big hits that have been in that style, just to give an idea of what that style is.
Like on the web or in
sure, yeah. In
the well, let's see. We had a bunch of different things on this list here. There's the traditional action games, which are probably the best well known games, you know, Halo 3 and that kind of thing. Console is very dominant in that category, although there's a lot of good PC games too. Counter-Strike is sort of an enduring favorite. Card games are certainly really popular in the casual game market. A lot of the casual game market, which is where most of my company's business is, has to do with games that are familiar to people already, games that people already know the rules for. Hearts, Bridge, Sudoku, like, you know, I mentioned earlier. And puzzle games, another category. I'm trying to think of some good examples of that. Even there was a time a few years ago when some of the biggest games on the web and in the downloadable space were all games like Bejeweled and Collapse that involved doing color matching. And I think, you know, it's really any day now somebody could come up with the next Tetris or the next Bejeweled. It's a lot of very simple mechanics, but that space is far from exhausted. If you hit on that, you know, that's a gold mine. Advert gaming is a really big sector of the industry still especially for companies like Wild Tangent, which aren't focused on really exposing folks to marketing messages. There's always money to be made there. And there are still, it's a very, actually very easy way that probably a lot of you who are working on larger commercial websites or for companies doing websites, if it's like a product marketing aimed website, especially if it's entertainment or kids. And games, as I'm sure many of you know, have become a more and more integral part of the online marketing strategy for those types of sites. And that can be a good way to make a move into games. That's was a big part of how I ended up doing games full time. Other genres, we've got role-playing strategy simulation on here. That's mostly been a PC genre. Casual games, like I was saying before, the games that are mostly played by a predominantly female audience, mostly in their 40s and 50s. That's the bulk of that game market, sort of contrary to popular wisdom about games. And the most popular genres there are either hidden object games, or sort of like Where's Waldo, but with different types of you know, much nicer artwork and things that that appeal to that audience. So, you know, many of them are travelogues going around the world and looking for objects hidden in scenes, as well as time management games like that a genre that was sort of initiated by one of my company's games, Diner Dash, where you are sort of juggling different plates. Doing plate spinning is another term we use for it, where you're trying to manage a bunch of different simultaneous tasks is sort of what that kind of gameplay boils down to. Then there's even further flung areas like serious games. There's an increasingly large field with lots of interesting opportunities being funded by a nonprofit, by the government. PBS has been doing a lot of those. Those are games where fun is not necessarily the primary reason to play, and that they can be educational. They can be trying to get a political point across. There's recently a very interesting game came out that's all about immigration reform. And then we've got, there's a huge number of kids games, especially in the virtual world area, which is a whole other topic. But especially on the web, some of the largest virtual worlds are on the web now, and they're populated by kids. Everyone talks about World of Warcraft having 10 million subscribers and possibly, you know, arguably being one of the biggest entertainment brands in the world. But in terms of numbers of users, there are larger worlds, such as Habbo Hotel worldwide, which are mostly used by teenagers. And there are more users than in World of Warcraft, although a smaller percentage of them are actually paying money. And those are all entirely running on the web. So that's sort of a quick dash through a whole bunch of different types of things, I guess.
A lot of different possibilities for whatever someone in the audience is interested in, and to be able to jump in. I know Philip, I first met when he gave a talk about casual games and some of his work with the two-player Sudoku. And so do you think you could, I know you gave like an hour-long talk before, you think you could summarize it down?
Sure. Yeah, the thing about casual games, first off, I've heard different definitions, and I don't want to come and just say, okay, this is the whole industry, because I've just done a few games. But what I can do is give you some takeaway that I've sort of learned just being in it a little bit. First thing about casual games, some definitions are just like a downloadable game, less than 50 megabytes, that usually has a try-by. And that's pretty much the definition that people will argue about. And I don't want to argue about it, but to me, casual games means you can get up and running really quick. You don't have to dedicate a lot to learn. And then similarly, you can just quit in the middle of the game. And I think Naomi saying familiar games, that's what makes sense for sort of this casual thing. Also, a growing target. You've got your console games hitting the teen boys or whatever. That's huge, but it's not exactly going to grow. Where targeting older female generally, or just older people, meaning, you know, over 30, maybe 35, depends on where you're at if that means old. But anyway, that's a growth market. And then the big thing that I took away that I would have thought otherwise is that casual games does not mean light, like L-I-T-E. And in fact, there's sort of a arms race in casual games to, you know, make them bigger and better. And the, you know, like the Xbox Live Arcade games, I've seen some material from Microsoft saying, you know, you figure you're going to spend $100,000 to $300,000 to produce one of those. Well, I can just tell you, if they put that number on a piece of, advertising about it, it's going to cost more than that. So that's not light, and those are definitely considered casual. So that's good and bad in a lot of ways if you want to be in that particular slice of it. I'm not saying all casual games cost that much. I'm just saying that it doesn't mean they're lightweight. There doesn't mean they're cheap. And then this whole thing, advergaming, I think that's sort of a layer on top of it. If if you have ads within the game, if you have skinnable games like this Tic Attack Poker I did, it's like very skinnable. Everything except the cards are skinnable and, you know, brandable, so they can have a Coke version or whatever. And that's really, really an important thing in anything that you'd call an advert game. Advert games can also be something where your client just wants a game added onto their, to sort of push their brand, and there's no money coming from the user, even sitting through ads. But just sort of stepping back to this arms race thing, if you're doing regular web stuff and you think you're just going to throw in a game, and also stepping back to that, the game has to be easy to get started really quick. This whole lip service about user experience and UI stuff being important in a website, that's totally true, but it's like way more true with a game, because someone's not going to just dedicate the time to really get in and learn the game unless there's some compelling reason why they want to. They don't want to. They just want a dumb game that they can just start going. So as far as budgeting it, I think you're going to see it might cost you more time to build a really good game, because UI is so huge. It's not just a thing you sort of hire some dude to make sure it's got good UI. It's the main thing. I don't know if there's other stuff about casual games, but I mean, it's a big term, and you can find a document. I forget the organization that they have a sort of every few years they publish a compendium of what it means for a casual game, and there's a PDF out there.
Are you talking about the International Game Developers?
Yeah, Game Developer Group.
Yeah, that's actually probably a good resource for anyone who's looking to get into video games. Is IGDA.org. It's the International Game Developers Association, and they have a whole bunch of SIGs underneath their umbrella. One of them is the casual game SIG, so if you're interested in that type of game. And I think what Philip is referring to is a white paper that they put out every few years that sort of describes the state of the market. So if you need some, you know, intelligence on, oh, okay, what exactly is going on here? What types of games are making money? What are the business models? That's a really good place to start. And that's just one of the mini SIGs that they've got. They also have local chapters. I think the Austin chapter has a whole booth downstairs in the arcade. Can I ask a general question of the audience before we continue?
Yeah.
How many of you would describe yourselves as an individual looking for a job at a game company? Okay, so only two or three. How many of you would you describe yourselves as someone who already has or getting started with or looking to start a game company of more than one person? And how many of you would describe yourself as an individual who is going to make games by themselves? Who are the rest of you? Okay.
Can you come up to the mic?
My name is Keith. I used to do a bunch of web work in the past, and now I've kind of moved into more hardcore programming. And the theme here at South By, of course, is more visual. And I came here to see kind of how the crossover works. Game development is obviously a very romanticized field within development and design. And hearing your guys' opinions on how the web-related skills translate was really what I was hoping to get out of this and really see where perhaps my deficiencies would help segue me into a bigger company, perhaps in the future, where I need to work on my strengths or build up my deficiencies.
So you're not looking for a game job right now, but you think you might be sometime in the future.
Yeah, it's one of those really cool jobs to have. And even if I just do it for a couple of years and then totally ditch the field, that'd be really a personal plus for me looking back on my life.
Okay, yeah, cool. That makes sense. You're doing some reconnaissance.
Exactly.
Right, okay, cool. So when you say like a word game, are you talking about something like Boggle or? Yeah, I mean, I think those games are around, and they're always going to be around. You see a lot of that type of stuff in small casual games on the web. Word games have enduring popularity. That's for sure.
But I guess what I'm saying is, are they trending down? It seems like the average game
that's actually not so true anymore, right? Like that was more true in the past, but now the average gamer is actually a woman, and the average age of gamers is something like 33. Right. So that's a good example. Right.
Let's go back to the mic. Sorry.
I'm especially interested in using games to train people, especially workers. My company, we train on safety and health in the workplace. And I think that using game as a medium for training a worker how to do his job or how to work safely, et cetera, could engage him, make it a lot more exciting. So I'm definitely looking for people that can help me to that end.
I can say something. Yeah. I mean, I did a lot of stuff in authorware, and then it was definitely towards training and other applications. But, you know, every time that my experience, and maybe this isn't going to help you, but it's pretty much always you add the sort of game on top of the training, and it's supposed to just kind of compel them. And usually it was concentration or some very familiar game, but the content was based on that. So the thinking was just simply they're going to be motivated just because it's fun. And then you throw in some information. It didn't really necessarily teach them better, but it did. It could improve their vocabulary. It wasn't exactly like a measurable thing that they improved. But quite often on training applications, I've had experience those types of games. But are you're thinking games that are like more integral to the content, or?
I think that's actually part of what the whole serious games movement is about, right? The potential of games as an educational tool.
Yeah, entertainment. I mean, obviously, right. That's I don't know, maybe a dead genre now.
Yeah, and that's I would, you know, a lot of people see that as a dead genre because it's been so hard to sell those as sort of products that are sort of halfway between education and games. But there have been a lot of attempts to integrate game-like attributes into education in other places where they're not. You know, where, you know, it's secretly a game, or it's a game and it's secretly teaching you something, you know, not trying to tell you, give you a mixed message about what you're doing. But yeah, I think games there are a lot of studies out there, if you look for them, that are, you know, reinforce the idea that games are an incredible educational tool that can do things that other forms of education really can't. You know, I think, you know, 100 years ago, people thought a common way of teaching things was, okay, just repeat this over and over and over again until it's drilled into your brain, right? Just do the times table, just memorize it, rote repetition. And now we know, okay, it's actually better and more engaging. You grasp, you know, more of the kids in schools if you have more active forms of learning, right? Well, games is sort of like ratcheting that up to the highest notch, just really putting you in the middle of the subject that you're learning and letting you play with it as a system.
I can make a couple notes to the question about, you know, what skills do I need if I'm a programmer wanting to get into games? Just maybe because I thought of them more recently. But I guess one huge thing for me was that the games are the budgets, the timelines can be really big. And so you need to be more formal with your work. And it's made me work harder as far as, you know, in the past where a client has some questions and they might have some idea, they don't really have a spec. I'll prototype something and that's our first rev, and then they comment on it and I keep prototyping. And prototyping's great generally, but if you're going to have this game that lasts a year to build, you want to spend the time to do a really good spec and sort of force sort of a more formal process. So it's not to say you can't make a web app that's huge. I just didn't do any super huge ones. Where the games, they were pretty huge because there were other people involved. And in every case, they always lived inside of another framework. So making a game for MSN Messenger, there's protocols to get the scores and all that stuff. And then when you port that to their web space, it's almost the same. It's very little. But the whole thing was I had to live in their framework. And it took a lot of work for me where, like, I know they could. There's just a simple thing, for example, on the Jigsaw, you make your window bigger, it doesn't scale. I spent a lot of time to make that thing work inside Messenger so that it resizes, but it doesn't get bigger. It just doesn't on resize and flash. And in their web space, it doesn't work that way. And I just said, well, I can give you the HTML for that. And it's like, no, it isn't going to happen because it's such a huge sort of back-end framework, so many other people involved, and you just have to live within their space. So I guess the two points are, you know, it can be a lot more work. You can really be more formal and then just realize you're sort of living in someone else's sandbox or playground. Those were kind of big takeaways as far as for me.
All right. So it sounds like a lot of people are wanting to, well, I guess not many raised their hand for it, but people are not looking for jobs in gaming. So I know a lot of people at South by Southwest work on very small web agencies. And Jameson, could you talk about kind of similarly small companies or even maybe not even official companies and how people have gone into gaming that way?
Yeah, we see a lot of individuals using our system because the barriers to entry into the platform space and even the casual downloadable space are getting higher and higher. And one of the beautiful things about the web is you can self-publish and you can generate content and you can make money from it. And there's a lot of different ways you can make money from it to support an individual. Most studios are not going to look at Flash as the de facto way they're going to take their company public. But for individuals and, you know, probably a lot of you guys, it's a very easy step to go from web developer to game developer. All you got to do is, you know, you can build your games in just about anything. We really focus in Flash, and we see guys anywhere from 12-year-olds to, you know, to 50-year-olds, and it really doesn't matter. You can sort of throw away all the traditional sort of ways of looking at popular games in that you don't need the best graphics, you don't need the best sound, you don't need the, you know, biggest budget to make a quality game. What the number one thing you need to do is just make something that's fun. And it's, yeah, and something that, like, you can play. You can take, you see juggling games, you see, what's that, like a paddle ball. You know, you see, like, they sell them at the local drugstore. It's a paddle and a ball, and you just bounce it up and down. And people have made games out of that, which for some reason or another, people are drawn to play. And we have stats on over probably 5,000 games tracked over the past 3 years. And I'm always amazed at both the quality of games and their correlative amount of traffic. Some games you see, you think it'd be all just god awful and nobody would play them. But for some reason, there's the web is a beautiful thing because there's a group of every sort of person out there, and you can reach one of those, some part of that group. So for the individual looking into getting into this space, it's a great opportunity, and Naomi really touched on it, saying that you want to go where it's the lowest barrier to entry and where you can sort of prosper the most. And definitely the web is somewhere that you can really make a big impact and not have a lot of competition right now.
Since you've got a lot of experience with that, how does sort of the revenue sharing work for your company with, like, I'm a developer, I hand you guys a game, what sort of, like, I assume that not all of them are actually paid for, it's like advertising sort of generated revenue, and
yep.
Maybe you could just talk about that for a little bit.
So we try and operate as a pure meritocracy. We do a 50-50 split with the game developer on any ad revenue that they generate. So if you make a bad game, we don't judge whether or not your game should be published. If you look at the traditional console world, you have to go through Microsoft or Nintendo to really get your game out there. But with the web, it's pretty simple. You don't have to jump through any hoops or barriers. It's you create a game, you put it out there. You can use our system to generate revenue from your game via advertisements. And if nobody plays your game, you don't make any money. If you build a popular game, that's great. We try to do the things to really help you build better games. What our company does is really enables people to focus on what they're best at, and that's the creativity side. And that's something that you can't systematically reproduce every time. So we handle distribution, we handle analytics, helping you understand who's playing the game. We handle the monetization, which is obviously the key part to help incentivize you to continue building more games. And then we have other tools and services like high score boards, you know, bringing other sort of advertisers that are interested in your games to the space. So to really get on, you know, how much money can you make? It's really, the sky's the limit. We have guys making, you know, getting six-figure checks every month to people that make crappy games that don't get any checks a month.
But Jameson, how do I know if my game is crappy or not before I release it?
Thank you. There's a lot of things that you can do, and it's really trial by error. And I think that's the beautiful thing about the web is, you know, we see people progress in their skill sets. The guys, you know, there's people that start off, they have their first game, they put it out there, they get a little feedback, they understand, you know, what they did right, what they did wrong, how they could have changed the distribution. It's really up to you. It's in your hands. Some people may like that. Some people may not like that. Some people may like the security of a big company sort of and having leadership driving you in a certain direction. But some people like the autonomy of having the ability to both create the game, do the marketing for the game, which is basically just trying to push it out there, and then getting the reward for it and analyzing the traffic and all that. So to really get to figure out, you know, how do you know if you've made a hit game? I think the most important thing is to really just, you have to enjoy playing it. Can you play this game every day for 15, 20 minutes to an hour? Do you get hooked? Can you give this to your mom and have her get hooked? It's, you know, test it out, try it with your friends. It's the beautiful thing about Flash is low barrier to entry. It's easy to work with. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to build a game in Flash, and it doesn't take a Picasso to, you know, to do great art. It's really easy. People make games in a week. We have a game that was made in 2 weeks that has grossed over, I think, 30,000 now, and that's not bad for 2 weeks of work, and something that you really like doing. So.
And what are some ways of getting your game out there once you've made it?
The way to get your game out there, there's a variety of ways, and I think the beauty of the web is, if you make a good game, you don't have to do anything, and because it travels on its own. You can look at, I think YouTube is a great example. You know, you see a popular video up there, people take the embed code and they spread it all over the web. They put it in their MySpace, they put it in their blog, they put it in wherever there's a place you can put something and share, sort of express yourself. And people do the same thing with games. If you make a game, number one, we can help distribute. We have partnerships with people, but you can put games up on your MySpace page. You can drive your friends to it. There's big gaming portals. There's Addicting Games. There's guys at Kongregate. You name it. Newgrounds is a great place. There's millions of Flash game portals out there, and you can just, most of them have submit forms, and you can just submit your game to them, and if they like it, they'll publish it. It's a ripe space right now for anybody looking to get into this industry. And I think one of the cool things that we were talking about it earlier is people have really, if you're looking to really make the jump into a more serious gaming world, the console gaming world, then Flash is a great step if you've never done it before. People like, there's games like Flow that started off as Flash, went on to PlayStation. There's Zookeeper, started off as Flash, went to the DS. You have Line Rider, same thing, Flash game. They got picked up by Nintendo for a license. Alien Hominid was a great game. Went over from Flash to PlayStation. So it's a great way to showcase your skills. If you make a cool game in Flash, then it'll probably work in other places.
Yeah, and the point about that, too, is that, you know, you can always port it. It's not like you pick a technology that you're going to study and you're going to get really good at and you're going to stick there. I think generally a programmer can learn any tool.
Or if, you know, if a big company is interested in you, then you might be able to get some funding out of them in order to, like, do whatever it takes to get it onto another platform. PlayStation 3, very difficult to develop for. It's a different matter than making the Flash version of Flow, but, you know, Sony made it worth their while.
And just real quick, I don't work for Microsoft. I'm on my own. I just wanted to make sure that was clear, and because I can get it, so I can get out of here, okay? And the other is, but there's a, they do have the XNA framework for developing on the Xbox Live, and I've heard really great things about it. Also, they have a pretty decent revenue share as far as the portal goes. It's not Flash, and you know, you gotta invest some money to build one of those games, but it's a nice, it looks real attractive, money revenue share wise.
How can you actually translate these games online and make money from them? You know, so many of the games that you see online, you're seeing for free and you're playing for free. So how is anybody actually making any money off of these?
You can splash an ad before it. You can integrate ads in the environment. And that can go real heavy as far as sponsorship goes. I mean, that can just be something generic, like there's a billboard inside the game and they just swap it out with a different brand. You can take that a lot further with... like the whole interface has got a theme. Like we have this jigsaw I did. It's very skinnable. They had a release for Harry Potter when that came out. The images are from the movie in the jigsaw, and then the whole interface has got that look. And similarly with other movie titles, they've sold it that way. And you know, so that's sponsorship / splash ads. Maybe there's other ways too.
You know, I was going to say, yeah, the advertising is the obvious answer right now. But with games like Flow, I mean, it didn't really matter whether there was any ads on that game or not. It was good and original and compelling enough that, you know, a big company swooped down and snatched it up. So that's another answer. I mean, you know, you can't just snap your fingers and make a game like that, obviously. But yeah, that if you make a good enough game, you know, somebody will want it. And the web is an excellent way of getting those games out there.
The three sort of primary forms of revenue that we see within the space for most of these independent Flash game developers is, one, advertising. We obviously provide that. Two is sponsorship. So you can find one sponsor. And there's actually a lot of sponsors out there online, and it's mostly game portals. Game portals will sponsor your game. They'll pay anywhere from $500 to $5,000 for a sponsorship. Obviously, the $5,000 games are pretty good. We just saw a game go out for about $10,000 just for the sponsorship to have the ability for this sponsor to put their name inside the game. And they don't obtain rights or anything. The IP is still the game developers. They just have the right to put their logo in the game. And then the third form is non-exclusive licenses. And non-exclusive licenses are, you created this game, somebody wants to put it on their site. Instead of stealing it, they obviously have to ask you for permission. So you can license it to them, and some companies will pay. The typical range is about $500 to $1,000 per game. So there's a lot of game sites out there that are willing to pay this sort of bounty to have your content on their site. And we see games get upwards to 13 different sponsors. So
yeah, and the licensing, I've heard it's sort of going down compared to other options. Is that fair? Say licensing isn't as hot as it might have been before, where, you know, if they want a sponsored version, you know, they want it really exclusive for them, as opposed to just you make your golf game and then you sell it a million different places. Great dream, but I just have heard that's not as hot as it used to be.
Yeah, so one of the things with licensing, people are willing to pay the licensing fee because, well, we're kind of throwing a monkey wrench into the play, because the games now have ads in them. And a lot of these sites, you know, if they may not want the ads in it, so they pay the developer to take the ads out so that they can license it. Otherwise, they would just take the game and the developer doesn't make it. So it's a leverage point.
There are other types of games on the web, too. There are, you know, what we've been talking about so far are small single-player Flash games, right? And there are also games that make money off of the communities of players who play them. If you look at entirely web-based, not incredibly high graphics, no animation games like Urban Dead or Travian, those games are you know, kind of some of them are quite profitable. Some of them are at least mildly profitable and self-sustaining. And Urban Dead, for instance, runs entirely on donations, and the donation gets you just a little bit of extra zing, like, you know, slightly better interface, slightly you know, more turns per day and things like that. And that type of model scales all the way up to item-based games. And some of the Facebook games are working that way now, where you play for free, but then if you want to get some extra stuff for your character in the game, then you shell out a little bit. So it's a microtransaction model. And I think that we're going to just see more and more of that kind of stuff in the future. That's a dominant model for small, this scale of game in East Asia, especially in Korea and China. And it's sort of been slowly making its way over here for the last few years.
People still make try-buy downloadable games. Similarly, with the premium version and the not premium version, you know, $10, $20. Xbox Live games are like 10 bucks, right? So,
Do you think that those type of games are ones that one or two people could create, or is that kind of a harder market to get into?
I think you think about budgets and, you know, $50,000 sort of minimum for a decent one. I mean, but, you know, stepping back to this, it has to be fun and all that. I mean, that was a big thing I learned, is that, you know, I was sitting there doing like a button rollover and I wanted this really nice animated thing, something that an agency would love me to do and sort of typical, but I just had to say, you know, step back and say, that's not the focus of this game. It's just to make the darn thing really work. So yeah, as far as those games goes, I haven't worked on any. The people I work with have had some history of that, and it's mostly director downloadable games, built-in director. And now they've kind of injected a little bit of life into that by supporting a new 3D engine and the new version of Director, which, yes, it still exists, the software called Director. But I don't know how much life is really there. But it's, you know, you can make money on these games. Basically, it's all in the portals and how long it's up on the top 10 list. And, you know, and then you get like whatever, 40% of the
money. And even if you don't go through a portal, if you understand the audience that you're targeting the game to, you can sell it directly to them on the web. If you know where to stick your hooks in, you can make a game that would seem like it was very niche. Like, for instance, there's a game that came out a couple of years ago called Cute Night, which is a very particular genre based on a Japanese genre of game called a raising sim, where you guide a young character through all sorts of moment-to-moment decisions that improve their statistics in different ways. And it had this very kind of like Japanese girls comics theme. Now, the conventional wisdom would be that game will not sell here in the United States. But everybody within a certain community and population on the web, and this is sort of related to, you know, Chris Anderson's theory of the long tail on the web, everybody wanted that game. So if you are part of a community or know a community well, and you want to make a game that's for that community and know how to market it to them, then, you know, you can make money off of it, regardless of what platform you're making it on.
Hi, I'm Adam. I work for a game development company, and I'd like to hear more about using the web to support console-based games retail-wise. In alternate reality games, stuff like that, more marketing-wise.
Was using the web to support a game that's on
right,
a console?
Not the web-based games, but using it to support console-based games or PC games, or, you know, driving sales.
You know, and do you have any examples of how anyone has done that so far?
Well, sure, like I Love Bees for Halo. There's been quite a few recently. But just what trends, what's working, what's not, how are you sort of getting people interested, getting people excited, things like that.
There's actually a session about that in the next time slot, the next door down. So
yeah, about alternate reality games, yeah.
Right, so that's the mashing up video games and our alternate reality games. Is that kind of what you're talking about? Or?
Yeah, that's part of it, but just in also generally speaking, taking your web skills to the game industry in a sense of taking it in sort of a supportive sense in like marketing. I work in marketing, obviously, but
it sounds to me kind of like a community built around the game. You're off playing over here, but then you go
that too. just any thoughts, that's all interested.
Besides ARGs and the sort of traditional marketing, which maybe doesn't need a whole lot of explanation, I think a lot of game companies know now that community, right? You got a people who like your franchise or who are familiar with your company, and yeah, right. they're on the web. They want to talk about your games.
Yeah, but do you have any thoughts on building those communities? How are you going about it? Things like that.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's not really within the scope of this talk. There are a ton of really good resources about that. You know, even going back a way, Amy Jo Kim's book on building communities on the web is a classic. I would still recommend that. I don't know if there's game specific ones that are about gaming, but yeah, it's a topic that's been written about a lot. It's kind of existing body of literature, how to make communities on the web support your product, whatever it is.
And a lot of that, I mean, if you look at the film industry, which has a similar sort of situation, a lot of that is farmed out to agencies. So it's actually not the company. It's, again, it's some sort of removed party. Mm. So it's kind of hard to say how that fits into the gaming business. It's really actually part of the marketing business.
One thing is, so that is one way to get a toehold in the game industry is if you come from an online community background. Maybe there's people in this room whose primary experience is with web communities. That can be a great asset to the game industry just because of exactly the things about.
And there are examples of people who have built up communities. Probably the best example are the Harry Potter communities. The people who built fan-based communities who have themselves become sponsored by the studios in order to do that, to sort of take it on as an ongoing work.
Sure. Yeah, that's a big source of new game designers and certainly new community managers is the fans of the product.
I did want to say one thing in all the sort of conversing we've been doing. The important thing is to do it. We can talk a lot about sort of the mechanics, but ultimately, if you want to take your skills into this gaming arena, you have to do something that that shows how you could do that. I mean, the people who had the most success when we were hiring for a company. People who'd have the most success were people who brought in, even if it was a rudimentary portfolio or a demonstration or something they'd cobbled together, whether it was character sketches because they were artists or whether it was programmer art, but this really kind of cool 3D interaction you could do and imagine these were really nice looking characters. The important thing, I can't stress enough, the important thing is to do something, to build a prototype, to do sketches, to write a story, to think through some gameplay and write it down and prototype it on paper or something. But and that's a lot of how we were. I mean,
mm-hmm, sure, make a paper version of your game.
In a big company, a big game video, everything, there's this huge funnel of taking ideas down to things that actually make it into the stores because they're so expensive to finally get out into the store. So what you do is you take 1,000 ideas and you do 100 proofs of concept, that you pay somebody 10 grand each to do, and then you get to the next stage where you give everybody, another 50 grand to take it to the next level.
10 prototypes, and then
you finally pick the one that you're going to invest $10 million in. So it is a funnel, and at any level. I mean, it's the same thing in the web. Don't let the fact that you can put anything else out on, put anything you want out on the web, and it's out there. There is still that funnel of attention, There's 1,000 games on a game portal. The popular list has 10. Somehow you've got to figure out how to get from the mass of 1,000 to 10. The only way you get to understand that is to do it. I mean, I can't emphasize enough that you won't know what good, we talked about the secret to success is having a great game, a playable, fun game. You won't have any clue until you try and build a playable, fun game.
I
was going to say, similarly, if you've painted this picture of yourself, you've said, I want to do this thing, first, don't necessarily worry about the money at first. That's important, but it's almost secondary. But if you've painted your picture as, I'm going to do these games, you just have to say no to the other opportunities, the other things that will necessarily mean you can't put that time into it. And I mean, for me, I finished the game in February, and I have said, well, I want to do another big game. And I've been holding out for a while, and I kind of have to take some other stuff. But it's sometimes worth it if you say this is my focus. Even it's sort of like this positive thinking thing. if you just keep saying, I am a game developer, I guarantee it's going to happen a lot quicker than if you say, I want to be a game developer, or whatever it is. And so that's sort of a generic inspirational thing that sort of helped me.
I'll just be the evil devil's advocate to that here for a second. Before you decide to make a game or even your idea for a game, there are a couple of things you should do. Play some games, especially if there's games out there that are like your idea. So you're not just making the same mistakes somebody else did, or even just, you know, making a similar game to what's already out there. Because originality is valued, and I think it's becoming increasingly valued for people who play games. And second, you know, there are actually some books that you can read, especially if you're confused about this sort of the stuff that games involve that the web doesn't necessarily involve, right? This whole mystery of what actually makes good gameplay. How do I know if I have good gameplay? I'll just plug Rules of Play, which is by two of my colleagues, Eric Zimmerman and Katie Salen, sort of good overall guide to understanding what game design is. And there's another book that's out more recently, and I can't remember the title of, but it's by Tracy Fullerton, who runs a program in game development at the University of Southern California. So I'll just mention, like, you know, another option is, pardon me, another option is go to grad school. That's actually, weirdly, is one way that you can get into games now. It didn't used to be the case, but games are increasingly professionalized. It's becoming more and more common at universities around the country that there are game programs that you can go in and learn how to make games. Of course, not all of the great game designers, probably very, very few of them at this point, come through programs like that. But the Flow guys that I mentioned before, who made the Flow Flash game, that team was from USC. You know, and then they've studied together in a game program and then started a company out of it.
Yeah, but don't make a list of all the things you have to do first before you go out and try it, too. That list can go on forever.
But if you're floundering and you don't know where to start,
a lot of the guys who went to film school started out with their Super 8 camera.
It's true. Yeah, exactly.
So
yeah, don't think that just going to school or reading a book is going to replace or do the trick for you either.
So Mike talked a bit about, and we're running low on time. So if you have a final question, you can go to the mic there. But talked about just doing it and how that had worked back before. I'm wondering whether you think with the web now it's even easier to be discovered as a game developer or one of the roles within game development. It's for anyone.
I don't. I think there's a huge amount of noise out there. So, you know, the guys who pick games aren't going to sort through that. You still have to have a way of distinguishing yourself. I think word of mouth is the... It's an enemy. I mean, if you think even about console games, you know, there are some things you can do to create buzz in advance, but if the game doesn't fundamentally deliver and people don't tell other people about it, so much so what. I think you need to have something out there, but I also think you need to know who to put it in front of. I mean, we used to steal. We would be looking for a game, and we would find a shareware author who had done that game, and we would pay him for his game. It's a time-honored tradition. Bill Gates paid for DOS, right? You find somebody who's already done the thing you need, and you go buy it, and you pay them to make it the way you want it, or make, you know, add features to it. So,
I think the story of Line Rider is an anomaly. It can happen for sure. It just, but you know, don't listen to someone who says, "Oh, it used to be different. Now it's harder." Just there's opportunities there, and I can't guarantee again.
And Naomi, how does Game Lab find people?
We tend to we hire mostly artists, probably artists, and they come through all sorts of, you know, schools of visual design. As far as finding new game designers, it's pretty difficult. We actually do hire game designers out of school who've gone to school for that. But I think it really is true still that the biggest recommendation is probably if you've been able to demonstrate your chops by actually making some kind of game, even a small one. And it's worth noting, if you're a PC gamer already, you ought to look and see if your favorite PC game allows you to make content for it. So modding a game or designing levels for a game, even a simple game, there are a lot of load runner type games out there and have been since the 80s that allow you to do level design. that's a way you can really show that you're a good designer and have those skills. And then another thing to note, what I think is really the strength for being able to get noticed, get discovered, so to speak, at this end, is that you don't have to be as conservative in terms of what kinds of games you're going to make as a giant company who has a $10 million budget has to be. So those companies make the same games, or, you know, make sequels, make clones of other games, make the same kinds of games year in, year out, because the budgets are so huge that it's enormous risk. If the game flops, or if it turns out to be a bad idea, it's a disaster. And what we were talking about with these little flash games, for instance, is that entirely the other end of the spectrum, right? The risk is lower because we're not talking about budgets in the hundreds of thousands or the millions, or not necessarily even in the tens of thousands, right? So if you have a new original idea, it's worth exploring if you think it has some potential. If you put it in front of some gamers, some people in the community you're targeting it towards, or even in front of your friends, and it's fun, then it's probably worth pursuing, especially if it's an original idea, because I think that's what larger companies are looking for from this pool, like this sort of the teeming tide pools of the game industry, so to speak, right? That there's all sorts of weird things going on there, like the ideas that are too risky or unusual are out there for the large companies to feel comfortable with. But if they can see, like, oh, somebody tried this idea and it seems to have caught on virally on the web, and we're going to snatch it up. And that's what happens with games like Flow and Everyday Shooter.
I mean, what's a cool game you could build with SMS?
Totally.
I mean, there's a free idea for it. I mean, I think that's you see so much activity around SMS, texting. Think about it. There's an opportunity. How could you tie that within with something that's web-based? It's limited by your own creativity.
Only SMS were reliable within 24 hours.
Well, if it weren't built on rails like Twitter, never mind.
Well, we actually have gone over our time now. I want to thank the four of you for coming down to Austin and talking to everyone about this. It's great.
Thanks, guys.
You have comment cards, and that would be very helpful to the five of us and to South by Southwest to know what you thought of the panel. Thank you.
And if you have more questions, feel free to come up and ask, I guess.